So it's very good to be back in Belfast. For me, certainly brings back memories of the research I did on my book on orangism, and I think the weather's helped too in terms of getting people inside the building. Also, I'd like to thank the Political Quarterly, and especially Emma Anderson, who's done a wonderful job. I did very little on this, actually. She did the organizing, so that's great. And very much like to thank our panelists for coming along. Copies of the special issue of Political Quarterly, which discuss this question of the peace process in the age of austerity, which is the theme of this panel, are distributed liberally around the chairs here. And also, if you didn't get one, there's more on the table. And what we tried to do, actually, at Birkbeck College, where we had a round table event with about 25, 30 participants, really was to ask the question of how does the economic austerity of the present affect the peace process, especially in a province such as Northern Ireland, which is whose economy is heavily tied to government spending. And the second major issue, particularly at the time, was that of what seemed to be a resurgent dissident republicanism and how that fits into the mix. Our panelists today will address this and also the broader question of the future of the peace process here in Northern Ireland. There's an order that's sort of specified in the program, which we're not going to follow, broadly speaking, but I will have Malachy O'Doherty kick this off. Malachy is, of course, a very prolific author. He's also a writer and broadcaster, and has written for the Belfast Telegraph and others, publisher of 5 books, most recently Under His Roof. Malachy, take it away.
Thank you. Actually, the next book is called On My Own Two Wheels, and it's about cycling. So I've been trying all afternoon to think of a cycling bicycle metaphor, you know, for the Northern Ireland peace process, and I can't come up with one. But if anybody wants to suggest one, I'll give it a hearing. I'm interested in a contrast between two different ways of contemplating Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland's past and Northern Ireland's potential. And I suppose, roughly speaking, I'll call those two ways memory and observation. Memory is a bit of an affliction in some ways, because if you have a memory that extends back to a previous generation and a previous upsurge of troubles, then you tend to carry with you an understanding of how Northern Ireland functions, and you tend to assume that the ways in which it will function in the future will be conditioned by how it functioned pretty much in the past. Whereas a more contemporary look at the society that you live in will see and uncluttered by memory, because perhaps the person doing the looking is a smart young academic of 24, will maybe will note light on things or focus on things which are uncluttered by memory of the past. If we look back, I'm of an age where I can encompass the span of the troubles within my own personal memory. I was 18 in August 1969 when the shooting started in the Falls Road, and in fact I was on the Falls Road that night. And one of the things that happened at that time that was if you like, very demoralising for people of my generation, and a surprise to people of my generation, was that having framed the trouble, having arrived at an understanding of conflict and division in Northern Ireland in terms which were contemporary and which had related, if you like, to Paris 68, to the civil rights movement in the United States, and in which agitation was expressed through a demand for British rights for British citizens, for instance. Then to see that the inheritors of all that energy and of all that anger and all that confusion were people who who did not see it in those contemporaneous ways at all, who took their bearings in regard to what was happening from the past, from a previous generation. People like Gerry Adams's father, people like Seamus Toomey and Joe Cahill and others, you know, Sean McStephan, were able to provide an explanation to young people of what it was that had gone wrong in Northern Ireland. And what had gone wrong was basically that British imperialism was resting its heavy hand on the whole thing, and nothing would ever be put right until Ireland was united and the Brits were expelled. Now, that's not to say that what drove the energies, what energised the angry people on the streets, was that particular analysis. What drove them, I would say, was other things. But that analysis was there, in a sense, instantly available to them, instantly available to the people who would lead them, who could provide weapons for them, and who could provide a legacy of mores of strategy and ways of fighting and ways of creating disruption and acting out their own past again. And I think, you know, we have to ask ourselves, if we're looking at dissident republicanism today, could this happen again? Could that sort of thing happen again? And I think I'm going to say, broadly speaking, that I don't think it could. One of the things that I find when I look back and try and put myself back into the head space that I was in about 1970, and I'm sure one or two other people here were in a similar head space at the time. One of the things that's amazing when you look back on that is, A, the diversity of political interpretations that were available, you know, at street level, in pub discussions, among political movements and political organisations and so on. To see and to ask yourself, you know, which of those, thinking inside the headspace of that time, which of these is going to thrive and which of them will die, and really some of them are quite extraordinary. I mean, I remember, I don't know how many of you have at hand a copy of the September 1972 issue of Playboy magazine, but I commend it to all of you for close scrutiny, for many reasons, but particularly for an interview done with Bernadette McCallisky for Playboy, in which she basically frames the whole problem within Ireland as a problem of imperialism to be defeated by socialism. And when she is asked how an independent Ireland, a freed Ireland, would sustain itself after the revolution, after we'd thrown the Brits out, she had no problem identifying the source of our future wealth in our mineral mining. And, you know, we don't seem to have just developed as far along along our excavations of our mineral wealth as Bernadette expected the chad, you know. And all, I mean, it's just an oddity anyway that Bernadette would have talked to Playboy, I don't think any ardent lefty political feminist today would dream of giving an interview to Playboy magazine. So what I'm saying is that if you go back to what was then, it was a slightly balmy time. It was a balmy time in which there was a giddy sense of revolution in the air. I've just been coming to an event where I was talking to Lindsay Hilsum, who's just about the revolutionary ardour and the feeling in Benghazi a year ago, and you know, it resonates with that. We had, as movements at that time, that might have come to, that might have grown, might have taken a commanding position within the politics of the future. We had, for instance, the Catholic Ex-Servicemen's Association, people who bore arms for the defence of Catholics and claimed their credibility and respect among the Catholic community on the basis of the fact that they had served in the British Army, which seems very, very strange if you look back and see the British Army or association with the British Army as a disgrace or an embarrassment. We had the official IRA, which was socialist, communist, lefty revolutionary organisation. We had the Citizens Defence Committees. We had the Provisional IRA. We had divisions within Republican groups. And then, of course, with the loyalist groups, the UVF, the UDA, and a smattering of groups like Serrera, Serolu, and God knows what, maybe even the Legion of Mary was up to no good for all I know. In fact, the Legion of Mary was up to no good. Take it from me. No. So, So out of that came the movement that, if you like, got it. And I didn't even mention the SDLP. What was I thinking of? You know, Connell, forgive me. But out of that, the movement that evolved to take a commanding presence within nationalist politics was the Provisional IRA masquerading as the SDLP, so which is what we now have. So when you look back to that time and say, what was it that out of that stimulated that ferment of political ideas, that revolutionary enthusiasm, that trouble, and that will to get armed, and that will among huge numbers of people to attack the state. And we have to, and I mean, there are many theories, and Kevin has written about a few of them, Kevin Bean, in his article in the magazine, and it's a fine article it is. And certainly there was an economic climate of the time that even is very hard to imagine. This hotel, I think, wasn't even built until about 1970, was it, 71? You know, we did, in its place, have a really quite beautiful GNR railway station, you know, which the older ones among us will feel some nostalgia for, but to hell with it, we got a hotel in its place. And we had a bleak city. If you were to do as I did often those times, get the number 12 bus from Casement Park down the Falls Road, and you look at the wee narrow streets named after Crimean battles, you know, like Plevna Street and Serbio Street, and you know, you saw a city in which housing was ugly and cramped. One of the interesting things, if you look at the photographs of people in those old days, is how differently they dressed, you know. I mean, look at the pictures of the first rioters in Derry. They're wearing blazers. You know, they're wearing tweed jackets, and, you know, and black polished shoes, you know, because, you know, they only have one suit of clothes, and it's for going to mass in, you know, or for a job interview. And you have to wear something else but your uniform when you come home from school. So can we imagine, and I suppose this is what I'm getting to, can we imagine that the climate of today is similar in any way to the quarry, if you like, or the birth of the Troubles in Northern Ireland? And in so many ways, it is completely unlike it. Certainly, we had austerity then, and we have austerity now. But we have austerity with most people driving cars. You know, I think in our street in Riverdale there were maybe four cars in 1969. We have austerity. You know, okay. So, and we've welfare benefits which are being cut, and we've grounds for anger. But do we have any prospect that the dissident Republican movement, which claims the legacy of the earlier struggle, as they would call it, that they could be the inheritors of the anger generated by austerity and welfare cuts? I think they have made a kind of a pitch for that by bombing banks, you know. And I think the reaction of most people to that is, "Hey, that's my bank." You know, I had an appointment there tomorrow to discuss my overdraft, and you bastard have just bombed it. You know, I think it's quite inconceivable that the ardor or the enthusiasm or the anger or the passions that would be roused by economic cuts, by financial cuts, by the marauding of our bank accounts, by our banks, or by the erosion of our pension schemes, that ardor would look to the dissident Republican movement for leadership. I think that is an absurdity. I don't think that is conceivable at all. So is there anything conceivable that would bring us back to trouble on the streets led by a Republican movement, led by armed Republican groups, or inspired by or in collusion in some measure with armed Republican groups? I think quite unlikely, but I would have said exactly the same thing if you'd asked me that in 1966, you know? Because, I mean, the amazing thing about it was that there was no sign of it coming. You know, okay, there was some trouble in 64 in Divis Street. There was a wee bit of trouble in 66 in the Loyalist killings of Peter Ward and John Scullion and others. But there was the sense that, you know, that the Republicanism was about to break up through the cracks in the pavements, you know, was an absurdity until it happened, right? And so we have to ask ourselves, what is it that happens in this society that is maybe not explained by poverty, that is maybe not explained by intelligent political thinking, and yet has the political power to create instant division? And I think what is in this society is, and it has happened about four times in my lifetime, what is happens is that moments arise in which division locks solid. Now, the it happened in 1969 when all Catholics in Northern Ireland would have said basically exactly the same thing if you'd asked them to define the problem. And all Protestants, whether moderate unionists or extreme loyalists, would have said something else. And it would have been the same thing among all of them. There are times in there are times when something seismic happens and the rift is solid. And in 69, the anger of all Catholics was against the police and against the Ministry of Home Affairs and the Stormont government, and the demand for the right to be on the streets, and the unified loyalist, unionist, reactive feeling was, well, that's the bloody IRA coming up again, and you know, you never know what's going to happen next, you know. It happened in 1981, and at that time it happened around the hunger strikes, when practically any Catholic, from John Hume to the Cardinal to the most ardent Republican, would have said, look, this can be sorted out with people dying in prisons, for goodness sake. And practically any unionist would have said, do you want a pasty supper, Bobby Sands, you know, and slab it into you. And the second time, the third time it happened, certainly was 1996 around Drumcree, when practically any Catholic or nationalist, from John Hume to Gerry Adams, from the most docile, innocent little granny in Ardoyne or wherever, to the most ardent political activist or angry journalist, would have said, for goodness sake, why do they have to walk down that road? Can they not just walk away? And practically any Protestant would have said exactly the opposite. Just let them walk, for God's sake. Right? There are times that something happens in this society, and I do not believe that it can be explained by austerity. I do not think it can be blamed, explained by simple political ideologies like republicanism or any other political ideology. It is presumably explicable by the fact that we simply have a divided society, but which functions well enough. But it is divided so deeply, and it has so often in the past divided so completely that you could not predict, God forbid, that it would not happen again, and it might, and I'm afraid it will not be austerity that will be the explanation, but it might be something that none of us has even thought of yet. Who knows? But it could happen, because it has happened before. So there you are, that's my bit.
Thank you very much. What I'd like to do is alternate a politician and a non-politician, and I'm aware that Paul Bew wears both hats, so he'll probably be last. So I think we'll start with Conal, and then move through to Katie, and then Peter, then.
All right. Well, I understand. You tell me when I've hit 6 minutes, and just check.
Right. Okay. I said 5 to 10 minutes for each.
Well, okay. Well,
sorry. Did I go over?
It's okay. So I was thinking maybe you'd start with Malachy's challenge on the old bike analogy. Well, two books about bikes. I like riding them too. By the way, one is called Not Dead Yet, and if there's any bike fans in the audience, you'll know it. It's a biography by a very, very good cyclist called Phil Sutherland, who happens to suffer and live with type 1 diabetes. And not Dead Yet is his story of being the world endurance cyclist champion and yet a type 1 diabetic and insulin dependent. And I suppose, where does the Not Dead Yet analogy hold true to where we are? Well, it's that there is a particularly sad, sick, unjustifiable brand of Irish republicanism that is not dead yet. Although I think, frankly, insulin, no insulin, its days are numbered. And that's not because I say so, it's because the people of Ireland say so. I spent this morning with a woman I'd never met before, but I think every one of us in this room will admire greatly. She lost her son yesterday, a year ago, just because he happened to put on a uniform and serve a police service. And she reminded me that if his death is to mean anything, that the mindset that imbues that tiny minority of Irish people who still think there is some legitimacy, which there never was, by the way, never, who still think there is some legitimacy in armed conflict, must be eradicated. And it is down to a generation of leaders, I suppose, which I have the privilege of being part, to do that. The other biking analogy I think that is worth drawing on, of course, is the Battle of Mr. Armstrong, Lance Armstrong's book. And he says it's not about the bike, And in that sense, I've always thought that this this stage of our political development must not be about the absence of violence. And at some point, we have to move beyond the vehicle that delivered us a democratic potential. And the vehicle that delivers Lance Armstrong, the tour after tour is the bike. Well, the vehicle that delivered us the conditions for what we have today is the absence of violence, but it can't be just about that. And I think we do fall a little too often guilty of reducing debate around here to being, well, it's, you know, better than the war. It's great, we don't shoot each other anymore. Should we be just happy for that? And that leads me to Stormont and to where Peter and I get paid to make law or not, as the case may be. And you know, there's been an epic decade, hasn't there? Really, it's been quite outstanding what's happened in the past 10 years. And where we've got to is a place of stability. No one, I think, seriously believes that Stormont will collapse anytime soon. No one thinks that the foundations of power sharing and equality are unstable. I don't know anyone who feels that. And I don't think it would be societally acceptable if we were to have instability in institutional terms. But we do need to ask ourselves whether, with the stability that we enjoy today, we are also potentially going to get stagnation. Whether the institutions will stagnate for the sakes of being stable. Whether the lack of effective political challenge within the institutions will ultimately undermine their ability to be transformational in the way that we all need them to be. Because the point of this process is to be transformational. And I find it really interesting doing my job at the moment when I do it in the party that I do it. And I find it interesting because, you know, I come from the boys who like to think outside the box about Irish nationalism. I come from the party that apparently challenged Irish nationalism to its very core in the 70s and 80s and was able to build a new construct within which Irish nationalism could consider itself, consider this region, consider the relationships between these islands. And if that is true, and I would certainly believe it to be true, well then there's an equal duty in my generation of SDLP people to continue to challenge Irish nationalism, to think about where we are and, more importantly, where we're going. And I think the point we've reached is the point at which we need to explore, understand and embrace the concept of region. It's an irony that traditional Irish nationalism is built on the most British model of democracy possible, the unitary state. The thing that the Brits make their own, you know, the thing that defines Britain as this sort of single entity, or historically did anyway. And then it's embraced by Irish nationalism. Historically, it's been the only way you could possibly govern Ireland, a unitary state with the Parliament in Dublin, to substitute the unitary state with the Parliament in London. Yet, the reality of where we are today and what we've all effectively signed up to is a federal solution. I mean, that's what it is, isn't it? I mean, no one goes around saying, oh, it's not a federal solution. It is a federal solution. We've created a viable region, a sustainable region, which is part of the island of Ireland, unless there are any creationists in the room and you want to argue the toss in terms of 2,000 or 3,000 years down the road. Love to see the perfect geological break point that would allow the six counties to float off towards wherever they might go. But I don't think that's going to happen, and it's part of the UK until the majority of its people so wish it not to be. So why doesn't it embrace the concept of region? And what does that mean for identity? Because I think there is an interesting thing happening amongst our people, particularly the new generation. And I think we have a generation of northerners growing up in our midst. People who are proud to be from here. Kids who walk through the door of that assembly to challenge us in the education service rooms about what we're doing for them. Kids who will be Irish, yeah, and will see me as a fellow Irish man. Kids who are British and will see me as somewhat different, but they're all Northern. Now, if all the great nations of the Europe are able to succeed within a federal context, why is it such a dirty word in these islands? And why would we the very group of people who are ready-made for that type of governance, not explore it and test it to its very limit. And I think that's the great challenge, I suppose, from my point of view, for Northern Nationalism, to embrace Northern Ireland, to make this region our own, and to say that our principle and first duty is to make this place work, to build reconciliation, which we have not even begun to do, the great outstanding item, the great ticket that no one has bothered picking up from the peace process, and to build prosperity, which of course is, you know, what everyone wants to do in politics, and to understand that the new Ireland is not ever going to be a unitary state, nor a nationalist Ireland, for if it were to be a nationalist Ireland, the new Ireland, it would by definition be the old Ireland, the divided one, because it would have a minority of people who would not be a part of it. And if that's a challenge for us, surely it's an equal challenge for unionism. Surely unionism must expand its sense of self to the point where it can understand that what's happening in Scotland is actually good for the Union, not bad for it. Because it means that the United Kingdom evolves into being a new type of state, with new structures of government, with new points of inflection that reflect the diversity that many who advocate its continuance wish to celebrate so much as being special and unique to it. I think a couple of other observations then to make about where we could be. Well, we could be in a society that is as prosperous as it is diverse. We could be in a society that sees the diversity of its people as a great economic opportunity. For ample a body of evidence, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the most diverse societies in the world are also the most successful economically, certainly the most productive. And it stands to reason. And if you had a bunch of economists in the room that specialise in this, I would hope they would agree with me. It stands to reason, because the positive tension of diversity is bound to create more intellectual capital than the sometimes lack of tension of sameness, the sometimes sort of boringness of sameness. We can also find ourselves in a place where we are able to accept our relationship with Europe. I'm always guided by Hewitt's remarks, and I'll finish up on these, Eric. John Hewitt was a poet, for those of you not from here. He's Protestant, he was a kind of social democrat, a bit of a lefty like me. He was from Belfast. His great mates are the guy called John Montagu, who Malachy and Paul probably could tell you more about than I, who was also a well-known writer and a bit of a republican like me as well, but a culty, not like me. In fact, he was from Tyrone, which is the antithesis of everything a Dubliner could possibly ever be, particularly on the football field. And they were exchanging letters back in 65 or 66 about what it meant to be who they were. And they were obviously, by reading these letters, having a bit of a row about what it meant to be Irish or Northern Irish. And of course, you weren't Northern Irish then, you were from Ulster. Of course, I was born in 1972, so I don't really understand that at all. But anyway, that's the way Hewitt would have described himself. And to cut to the end of the letters, there's this great passage where they talk about the levels of identity. And Hewitt's trying to say, see, the problem with unionists is that they can see the Ulster beneath their feet, but ignore the island Ulster's on and are obsessed with the big one next door. And he says, and then there's the Irish nationalists, the party, the SDLP, destroyed for better or for worse in the late 60s and early 70s. And he says, you know, they're a bunch of green Tories, let's call a spade a spade. And, well, they can see, you know, the island Ulster's on, but ignore the big one next door and really don't understand that there's a continent afar. Talks about Republicans, much the same terms. And he says, but the sad reality of who we are is that we are a people on the island of Ireland. And this island has an inextricable link to the big island next door, and it is part of a continent called Europe. And until we understand our identity at all those levels and are able to interface positively in governance terms at all those levels, we will never be who we could be. And I think the mission of the SDLP, for as long as there is a vote left in a ballot box for us, is to celebrate and stand for that type of politics. A politics that says you can be for this region and for this island, you can be part of these islands, but you're always European. Thanks very much.